Hello there, I'm Patricia Glynn, and this is Story Catcher. Simple stories, simply told. Welcome to Potpourri, a monthly collection of short stories. They're universal, they're everyday, and they're about the kind of dramatic events, small joys, and certain sorrows that happen in all our lives. Most importantly, they're your stories, submitted by you and recorded as I travel the subcontinent in my beloved truck, Lady Alexandra. So you're in charge of where I go and when. Please get your suggestions to me as soon as you can via our submissions page so that I can collate the stories by theme and or region and then set off. This month, stories from the safari capital of South Africa, Hoedspruit. But they're being recorded and put together in my camp in the Magaliesberg. What you hear in the background is the breeze playing with the canvas of my tent and the frame squeaking in response to the gusts. So once again, this is a safari studio and I hope you'll make allowances for that. To Hoedspruit then. No one can accuse me of not working for these stories. It took three trips to the Lowveld to bag them. First, I went on a recce in my old Pajero. Then I went in my truck, Alexandra, on the pioneering trip for the Story Catcher project. And it was a disaster from beginning to end. The camping plek on a game farm in the mountains that I'd naively chosen took a whole day to grade and prepare. There was a trip to the vet because Blitzy had a fall, a sliced tire, courtesy of the champion potholes outside town, a spare tire that we couldn't dislodge from its nest beneath the vehicle, and a full day's trip into town to sort out each of those glitches. Then I got a call from home saying that my tent had been broken into and that I'd been robbed. Big time. So I rushed back without a single story in my story catcher satchel. Then the virulent tummy bug struck, and then, and by the end of the thens, I had lost at least a fortnight of recording time for this story catcher episode. And the stories I'd researched were all up in Hoedspruit. So back I went, this time by means of transport that was fast and inexpensive. And do I mean fast. Starlink offers a shuttle service by minibus between Pretoria and Hoedspruit. It also offers tourists an unforgettable experience on the roads of South Africa. Another unforgettable experience came in the form of the super solicitous attention of my hosts, Michelle and Billy Cochran, who put me up during my visit, drove me around, and fed me. When I wasn't indulging my taste buds in town, that is, there are so many restaurants. There's a Big Pick and Pay, an even bigger spa, and I reckon Woolworths can only be a month or two away. The town, Hoedspruit, is booming. It's allegedly the fastest growing town in South Africa, and you hear continental accents all over the place. Dutch, French, German folk, that's them mostly. They're attracted by the combination of an airport on the outskirts of town, Kruger Park and other game reserves almost as close, and so-called wildlife estates needing occupation. These are like the high-security, upmarket suburban developments you get in the city, but most of the property here is designated for wildlife. So you can walk your dog in the afternoon and watch the resident leopard on the prowl later on your camera trap. I must say, I sense disaster looming with that particular combination of estate inhabitants. But what do I know? Anyhow, where is the Hoedspruit I remember from my last visit? Albeit 30 years ago. It was like an outpost then, servicing the few farmers and game lodges up north. There was a small bank, I seem to remember, a rather frayed hotel, a garage, and a general store where you could buy emergency provisions that didn't include long-stemmed broccoli. The village was full of Land Rovers. They were the big thing back then, not Toyotas. Driven by chaps in two-tone khaki shirts, faded blue rugger shorts and sockless fellies. Do you remember them? Their legs were well-muscled, tanned and dusty. Thankfully, despite the arrival of upmarket stores and even more upmarket residents, you can still sometimes spot some well-muscled, tanned and dusty male legs. Not many, but some. The swanky lodgers have decided that men of the bush should wear long shorts and branded shirts. And I swear they all go for teeth whitening. I ask you, who can get properly khaki fevered over that? Some joker once described Hoedspruit as a safari town with a drinking problem. Locals are proud to tell you that it's a drinking town with a safari problem. I lean towards the latter description because the folk up there hardly let the sun go down without watching it together with a G&T or a beer. Just outside town, there's a bridge that's no longer in use, and we had a great time there while the sun slipped away behind the Klein Drakensberg. In short, you're struck by how happy most Hoedspruiters seem to be. Many of them are retirees, you know, quietly pottering through life. Those who do work have a healthy work-play balance, and they really do value being close to wildlife. And because they're close to wildlife in attitude as well as proximity, they bear the brunt of the all-out onslaught against it. Hoedspruit is a town at war. It's on the frontier of the battle that's been fought for the future of our wildlife. All of it. From rhinos and elephants right down to scrub hares. Underneath all the jollity, the town thrums with tension and whispers. Who got through which fence last night? Got away where? That's why Storycatcher this month brings you stories of the Lowveld's many wildlife warriors, to whom we owe so much. But not exclusively, I've added a few others which you would not be expecting. Such as the one about a thriving boudoir photography business. It's just charming. Enjoy, and keep sending me your story suggestions, please. That's what keeps us on the road and making podcasts about the fascinating people of Southern Africa. So, because we're in the safari capital of the country this month, we're going to start our potpourri collection with a chat that has got nothing whatsoever to do with safari. I mentioned in my introduction that Hoedspruit is on the march. So much so that it has its own radio station, Hoedspruit FM. And one of the presenters on the station is Luelle Viljoen. Now, hers is the kind of story that I love and that I think defines what Storycatcher is all about. Because it's a story about an ordinary family with some very out-of-the-ordinary challenges. Luelle Viljoen's parents were both deaf. And when you're a child, that presents some difficulties, I would have thought, which is why I was interested in hearing Luelle's story. It was only when we chatted that I learned that Luelle's childhood challenges were far greater than having deaf parents. Her mother was in a school for the disabled in Worcester, in the 1940s and 50s. You might remember that in those days, institutions like these were described as catering for the deaf, dumb and blind, meaning that despite the fact that Luelle's mum was able-bodied, intelligent and sharp, she shared a classroom with kids who were severely mentally and physically compromised. When she turned 18, her mother, Luelle's grandmother this is, decided that the best future for her daughter lay with someone who was also deaf, and so she arranged a marriage.
My father used to come to Cape Town quite often, and my grandmother saw this bachelor that was fairly well educated, but he was much older than my mother. And my mom was now 18, 17. And my grandmother then made an arrangement that my father must come and fetch her. And she literally thought she was going away for a weekend. She didn't know that she was going to get married.
Hang on a minute. She was 18.
He was 47, I think. But there's just under a 30-year age difference between the two of them.
And your grand thought this was a good idea?
It was perfectly normal. It was perfectly normal because she was getting so old. My mother told me that she felt that she wouldn't be able to look after her. And if she dies, who would look after her? So she felt better knowing that she would have a man that looked after her.
Who had a similar challenge?
Yes, that had the similar challenge. He was older. He had a secure job. And he then took her where she left Cape Town, Worcester, packed a little suitcase, and he took her down to Pietermaritzburg, to Natal. And before she knew it, they were in court and they had got married.
I'm trying to put my head around this girl getting into a car, and they're going further and further,
further and further
away, and she's saying, where are we going?
And it was, I still remember my mom saying to me that he eventually said that they're going to meet more of her family that lives in Natal. And when she got to Pietermaritzburg, so he took her to his house, and this is where she was staying. So
she didn't even go away with a letter in her hand.
No, not an explanation.
This is hard.
Very difficult, very sad. Then living in Pietermaritzburg, she managed to eventually get herself a little job, and my father was working. And then from those years onwards, we are six children, but we would have been eight. She had two miscarriages. She didn't want to have children, so she self-induced her miscarriages, and she would go and get a mixture to drink from someone that they knew that was a nurse and try and take this concoction, and they would jump off a cupboard, or she would use the coat hanger. And these are the sad things that women that are uneducated, not exposed to the outside world as we know it, and has no one to turn to.
Kendra, so I'm hearing intense loneliness.
Yes, lots of anger. Yes, lots of anger and resentment towards my father. I never remember a loving relationship between them. And there were times where she just wanted to freak out. She would have these meltdowns. And I still remember clearly, we grew up in Pietermaritzburg, and then we left Pietermaritzburg. She had a better job opportunity. So when we moved up, my father had already was on retirement. And he was already in his early 70s when we moved to Johannesburg. I would say about 68, 69 years old. So already then he was never a father figure. He was always just an elderly person. And then moving to Johannesburg, we were even more isolated in terms of my mom then worked full time. And we were just left to ourselves.
What I'm trying to imagine as well is Luluel as a little girl. And if she wants her mum's attention or either of her parents' attention, she's got to touch them.
Yes, and you learn.
How did she learn that? How did you learn that?
So you just learn as you grew up, like you would speak in any other language, you realize that you have to touch. So I had to touch my mum, to pull her and then show her. Show her what we wanted. And so it was a lot of patience, which was not there. And it's also, it becomes quite a, like when I say rough language, you think sign language is soft and it's not.
It's minimal.
It's minimal and it's evasive and it's hard. There's no emotion involved in sign language. So it was difficult to express your emotions. So we had a very hard relationship with both my mother and my father.
But let me just take it back further. You're a kid in a cot and you're screaming your head off.
It was a
feeling. But no one can hear you.
No one can hear you. But my mom, she also explained to us that it's a sensation that she has when her baby is crying. She would know when we were crying because she would have that feeling. And only later on, you know, she explained to us about vibrations and the beats of music. If we put the speaker on next to her, she can feel the music. She can't hear it, but she can feel the rhythm of it. And only at a later stage did we have a system installed with our doorbell at the front door that would have a light bulb connected to a light bulb in every room.
Yeah, I'm sure you kids became her
ears.
Her ears.
Yes, yes.
And that, in a way, puts quite a lot of pressure.
Tremendous pressure, because you are not wanting to say certain things, and she will tell you to say things to adults, and you are embarrassed, and that sometimes it's stuff that you don't understand.
And your father was just this remote figure.
Very much a remote figure in our lives. And he was a good, healthy man. And he then landed up getting a stroke when he was 71 years old. And unfortunately, he had an incident where his leg that was lame had been knocked around a few times, and he caused gangrene on his leg. So they had to amputate his leg and then again. And my mom tried to keep my dad at home. And it was terrible because we were all responsible as young girls to look after my father. He then went backwards altogether, and he was bedridden, completely bedridden. So at this tender age of 14, you are changing your father's diaper. You are being kept off school because one of us has to be at home. The things that you are exposed to, it's very difficult to deal with. And at the same time, you are angry with your mother. Your mother's angry because she can't provide more than what she can provide. So it was very heart sore, and for my mother as well. But she did tell us that she eventually loved him very, very much, and she grew to love him very much. And she did. She did her very best as what she could do.
There's one thing I didn't cover with you, and that is your mother went deaf at two. Was that meningitis?
It was just a lack of medical care. She had very bad ear infections, and they just didn't have access to proper medical care. It was just never looked after, and her eardrums eventually got rotten, and that caused her to have them both removed because they were completely, they'd literally disintegrated in her ear. They had left one eardrum in her, and at a young age, about 15 or so, my mother was raped, and she got badly beaten up. And the beating resulted in the removing of her last eardrum that she had, that she could still have a little grommet in her ear, that she could still hear a faint noise. And that was another thing I didn't mention, was because that had happened to my mother, my grandmother felt that she was more ruined than ever. And no one would want her. So that's why she also wanted my father to take her. And the thing is, with people that are deaf, the way they tell you a story is, it's a vulgar, because they go into detail and they not just show it with their hands. You know, it's about beating and hitting and what they did to her. And it's very emotional. It's a very sad,
It's not
right.
Nuanced at all.
So it's a very hard message to receive. But the fact that she still persevered and she still managed to look after herself, look after six children, after my father passed away, and until the day she passed away, she was still such a magnificent woman, and I will always, always remember her and look up to her for what she sacrificed in her life for us. We still had a good childhood. We grew up very wise, much streetwise than the regular kids, and grew up in government flats with the soup kitchen the recreational center used to provide, aftercare for us. We would go and get our milk, our bread for the week. It was so normal. We didn't know any different.
Give me now how this has all played out in your life. You seem to me to be extremely industrious.
Yes.
And a very, very hard worker.
And, you know, we all are. All six kids are. Every single one of us pushed and have worked very hard. My sister, that's a year older than me, fell pregnant, unfortunately, when she was 15 years old. And, you know, my mom always said to me, you are going to fall pregnant, because I was always the loud one. And I vowed to her that I would never. And I vowed, growing up in the environment, that I will be better than this. I do not want to land up young, married, and pregnant. And I always wanted to be an air hostess. I always wanted to travel. And so from about 19 onwards, I used to apply to the airline, South African Airways. I used to send them a letter requesting to come and be an air hostess. And they always replied back to me, but I was just never old enough. They said it needed to be 21. And I just kept applying, even if it was just to get a letter back to say, thank you, thank you, thank you. And literally 8 or 9 months before I turned 21, the airline phoned me. Sent a letter, actually, to say that I've been given a date for an interview. And I travelled to every overseas destination that South African Airways could travel to.
If I were to ask you to give me a synopsis of your philosophy of life, given how you were brought up, what would that philosophy be?
Well, you know, I think for me at the end of the day, growing up like it gave me so much more courage to face adversities. because I had seen girls that were my age that had everything that threw it all away. And I just wanted to always just represent myself and be proud of where I'd come from and how I grew up. And even if I had to take it back, the things I would do again would be not my upbringing, but the fact that I would have worked harder at school. I would have been more educated. I would have persevered to go and study after school. But I would never, ever want to take away what I went through. And it's made me who I am today.
All of which, I bet, makes you want to see pictures of the people in her family that Lowell has been talking about. And you can see those pictures if you click on the deck of pics that are attached to her interview. Lowell Filion can be found at the Hoedspruit FM radio studios most days and most nights at a food truck come restaurant called Yum. And yummy it is for sure. Next, a chat with someone who's largely airborne in the operation to bring the rampant poaching in Limpopo's reserves under some kind of control. Jerry MacDonald is one of twin brothers. They grew up on a game farm, and their father was among the very first people involved in game capture and relocation. It's an exciting business, and it's no surprise, really, that both brothers decided to make it their living. So nowadays, you can often see Bruce in a fixed-wing aircraft in the skies above the Greater Kruger, and Jerry in a helicopter flying below him. And they're up there for a lot more than just excitement, of course. You'll know by now that I have a special place in my heart for dogs. So I started my chat by asking Jerry about his involvement with the use of dogs in the anti-poaching war.
We do a lot of free-ranging dogs, pack hounds, which will have the handler and the helicopter with us. They have GPS tracking collars, and we'll follow them from the air. So we'll put them onto a scent, and then we'll be top cover, either with the fixed wing or the helicopter, but more the helicopter. The pack hounds are actually, it's been a game changer. I mean, in Kruger, they arrested close to 100 poachers just with the dogs. It's been an amazing game changer, honestly. Yeah.
So they're let loose from, 100 kilometres away, 50 kilometres, 20 kilometres?
Yeah, around. I think a good sort of distance would be 20 to 23 k's. People have done a lot more, but the temperatures are so hot, so yeah. The dogs battle with the heat. But generally, I reckon 20 k's is a good track to take.
And the identification of where the poacher is that done by air?
No, so what happens is generally what will happen, they'll do the roads in the mornings, and dogs will pick up tracks, or rangers will pick up tracks where there's an entry point. Once that entry point's been found, then they know it's fresh enough, they'll call the dogs. Two different kinds of dogs. There's the line dogs, and then there the loose free range pack hounds. So
the lion dogs.
Lion dogs.
That's like ridgebacks.
No, not lion, lamb.
So lion, okay.
So basically it'll be like a Malinois or that kind of dog, which will be on a leash. So they're not free running. The range is still going on a leash. Yeah. Pretty effective as well.
Yeah, well, their intelligence is legendary. But the pack hounds are not on leash, and they just run ahead.
Yeah.
And they chase that spoor as fast as they can.
Absolutely. And they're amazing. To see them out of the air is just next level, the way they operate.
I'm sure. From the air, you get the best view.
It's amazing, yeah.
And they get to the guy.
Yeah.
And then they train to hold him at bay.
They actually bite. Their reward is to bite, yeah. And certain dogs are trained differently. A lot of guys are training them not to bite now because picking up a bit of trouble as far as that goes. But generally,
from the law, by the law.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, forgive me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, I feel the same. Yeah.
So they just, it's like they used to in the old days, they'll hold him at bay.
Yeah, and then we would have caught up with the helicopters and the fixed wing. And there's no ways they can outrun those dogs. It's just physically impossible. So,
and can the dogs hold more than one guy at bay?
They can. But generally, these guys, once you're on their tracks, they'll split up immediately, each one for himself. They don't stick together at all. Maybe two, but generally they'll go their own directions. They're not really loyal to each other at all. It's free for all there.
So, but then that provides a problem for the dogs, doesn't it? Because if they're 8 or 10 hounds, how do they keep three who've gone different directions?
It can be a problem, but generally they'll stick to one track and take the ones. If the dogs work together, they work as a team. So they'll never split from each other. They'll always run as a pack. So whichever tracks they've got, they'll keep going with it. They won't split off and do their own thing. Because while they're running, they're communicating with each other. It's actually amazing to watch. Eh?
They are what kind of dogs, these pack hounds?
It's a breed from it's Texas. They used to be called coon hounds back in the day.
Yes.
You know, and they've been used for tracking Mexicans on the border patrol for years and years. So they've been trained to hunt people. Whereas our dogs in this country have been trained to hunt and take tracks of animals. These dogs will run straight past a lion track or a rhino track or anything. They'll just keep on the human scent. So they're specifically trained for humans. That's why they're better than most of our dogs here. They've been trained for humans for hundreds of years. So it's basically bred into them.
I've got to see that. Now, I presume that is the most exciting aspect of your work, is it?
Oh, gosh. Every single day is exciting. There's just so much that goes on in one particular day, whether it be rhino, horn trimming, to anti-poaching. I can be sitting here just getting my helicopter ready and I'll get a call, you know, there's poachers in Sabi Sand or Bulu or Chim Reserve, and you've got to be able to respond within 5 minutes. That's why normally the machine's fueled up and waiting, so you never know what to expect. We do a lot of work with Farm Watch here as well, which are brilliant in this bed.
So you too can keep a poacher at bay, but it's not as if you can shoot from the air with the aircraft. So what do you do?
No, so generally the guys on the ground will be doing that. Look, if they do start shooting at us, the game changes completely. There are laws. If they do start shooting at you, you can then act on that, you know.
So, but if you're not shooting, what are you doing there?
Providing top cover. So the guys on the ground will be on the ground and we'll be following the dogs. And then to see if any of the poachers break cover, so you just keep an eye open. If they do break cover, at least we've got a direction.
And have you been shot at?
No, not yet.
Well, exactly, not yet.
I think what's happened is the guys are getting more brazen and they're taking more risks. People have taken shots. I mean, Kruger Park's chopper has had shots at them. So it can happen, and it's going to happen, because the more desperate they get, the more brazen they get, they're going to start taking those risks for sure. And we're well aware of that. Yeah.
Can you do something to the belly of your craft?
Not really, because that stuff's so heavy.
Mm.
So it's a weight issue. But what we do is we put that bulletproof vest underneath the seat for what it's worth.
And here it comes, the pun that completely passed me by. You know, there's that expression, flying by the seat of your pants.
Mm-hmm.
I am told that that is how you fly, in this instinctive.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that you're reckless,
yeah,
but you are completely instinctive. When you get up there, you are one with that craft.
Absolutely, yeah. It is like that. It becomes part of your, an extension of your body. And I think that's why it's got to be, you know, because it's such a dangerous type of work. You can't think too much about the flying. That's going to come naturally, which it does for me, luckily. And that's thousands of hours as well, you know, so it takes a while to get there. But yeah, it definitely, by the seat of your pants, that's very true. Yeah.
So you get down and are you comforted that you haven't taken any risks? No, I don't think so.
Look, this kind of flying requires you to take risks.
Mm.
But within limits, and you don't push it past the limits. You know exactly where the limits are. I think once you start pushing the limits too far, you're seriously looking for trouble. I think it's probably one of the most dangerous type of flying. You're in amongst the trees, you're low level, you've got the animals' behavior. I think more importantly for me anyway, more than the flying, it's understanding animal behavior. Every single animal reacts differently to the helicopter. So, example, impala, like this huge moving amoeba that you have to sort of guide, and if they run, they go, just let them run and bring them back slowly, you don't put too much pressure on. Whereas the wilderness and zebra would just be, they run pretty straight. So it's you can sort of point them to the bottom. It's like scoring a goal, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying to say is it's more understanding animal behavior. than the flying for me.
Identify and guiding the herd leaders in this exercise, you know, the matriarchs and the patriarchs, is critical. And that's where Jerry's experience plays such a vital role. I mean, almost all of us could probably identify the matriarch of an elephant herd simply by her size and clear leadership. But what about the other mammals?
Yeah, a zebra herd was typically between 5 and 9 to 12 animals in the herd. The stallion reacts completely differently. He looks after his herd. So he'll be running around the back and, you know, keeping them together. So you'll see exactly which one the stallion is from the get-go. You can't see by any shape, color, or size. But just by the way he operates and he sort of keeps his herd together, you'll know exactly which is the stallion. So I see the zebra, the stallion as the sort of pack leader. Rhino, I think bulls and cows, pretty easy for me. If you're not used to it from the air, it's quite difficult. But for me, I've been doing it for so long now, you can pick it up quite quickly. Yeah.
And they're not really in little herds.
Rhino can be up into crashes of maybe 6 to 8 sometimes. So yeah, but generally it'll be 1s and 2s. Like the typical rhino herd would be a cow with a calf and a bull. It's generally there.
Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of what you're doing now is just to dart them and try and get what is left of their horn out.
Yeah.
Which is like an excavation exercise. It's revolting.
I know. We shouldn't be doing this. Every time we put a rhino down, you think, geez, why are we doing this? And what do you do? You know, it's the only thing that's working at the moment. The guys can say what they want. I know it's invasive. It really is, but it works. I don't think by any means it's the silver bullet. It's buying us time. Because there's going to come a time where all of the runners are dehorned or trimmed, and they will start targeting them even for a little bit of horns. It's going to happen, we know that. But for now, and Kruger for the first time this time, since they started dehorning, they've been dehorning full scale for the last 2 years flat out. And for the first time this year, they've got a positive growth in their honour. So that shows you it works. That's it. I mean, it's proven.
Wouldn't the poachers want now to down them in spite?
Has been done. They have done it, especially at night when they can't really see the horn as well. I mean, some of these guys, I mean, they've been hippo shot at night because they can't see, they think it's rhino. So they really can't see too well sometimes, but generally, if it's got a little bit of horn, I mean, even the babies, they get hacked and a little bit of horn gets taken off, so that's how bad it is. Eh? Yeah.
So a lot of what fuels you is rage.
What fuels me is I'm passionate about conservation. I live for it. I'm born in the bushes. And I'll do anything in my power to protect these animals. And that's what I've been given a job. And I feel that's what it is. I'm just really passionate about what I do. I'm very fortunate to be in this position. And the fact that it can make a difference, I think that's important for me.
And don't we just owe Jerry MacDonald and his fellow fighters such a huge debt of gratitude for what they're doing on our behalf? Because the wild and its wildlife is our national asset, our national treasure, and we're leaving it up to so few people to defend it. On a completely different tack, though, if you're up in Hoedspruit, Jerry will take you for a spin in his heli, for a fee, of course. Have a look at his website, Big Game Heli. I said in my intro that Hoedspruit is at the sharp end of the war against wildlife poaching, and I meant it. I think you could say that this team is among the most committed to the protection of the Greater Kruger Park's precious wild creatures. It's an elite unit known as the Black Mambas. What sets this unit apart? It consists only of women. These brave and intrepid young women, all carefully selected from the local community, make up the world's first all-female anti-poaching unit. They patrol 20,000 hectares of South Africa's Greater Kruger National Park, mostly in the north. Colette Ngobeni is one of them, and she's my next guest on Potpourri. She, as you will hear, is a vibrant, dedicated, energetic young woman who takes a job very seriously.
Is this the map here?
Yeah, here is our map. So, normally we patrol here. Do you see these red dots?
Yes.
The red dots, it's where we patrol. And then the dots, black dots, it's where we removed the snares. Because back in the days, when we started, we normally come back with 50, 40, 60 snares. So, but
per day?
Per day, yes.
How do you carry them? I mean, that is a lot of wire.
Yes. So these days, we normally come back maybe with 2-3 snares or 1 snare. And a lot of snares are the old snares.
So is it your impression that you are winning?
Yes, we are winning. We are winning. The Black Mambas and Poaching Unit, we are unarmed. The reason we are unarmed is because we don't want to see widows in the communities. We don't want to see orphans in the communities. Because the people that are poachers, they come from the same community that we are coming from. And at the end of the day, the people who are going to suffer, it's us. Because we'll always see their wives, we'll always see their children. So that's why we are doing it in the different models, that we don't want to kill. And then, or we don't want to place life of human being over life of wild animals. What we need to do is to protect the animals and protect those human beings in the community.
So if you know someone living in your community who is a poacher, how do you, Colette, handle that?
The problem is you can't tell that he's a poacher, he's not a poacher.
But you would have information, wouldn't you, if there was a close community?
Even
no?
If it's a close community, because people, they know that I am one of the Black Mambas and the Poaching Unit. The information, it's hard to reach me. Because these people, they don't want to be known as poachers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the problem. But we all know that the poachers, they come from the same communities that we are staying in.
So I'm trying to understand how you ladies work then. You do things like night patrols and all of that, and you're unarmed, which makes the job very dangerous because now we know the poachers are more and more and more armed with bigger and bigger weapons, correct?
Yes.
So is it just a matter of time before you ladies get armed?
We are not going to be armed at all. Because the poachers, yes, they carry guns. But these people are not there for human beings. And these people are there to do the quick job, so then they can go out. That's why we are the eyes and ears of the reserve. When we patrol the fence in the morning, the people will see us going up and going down. At night, they will see us shining the spotlights. Because these people, they don't want to be caught. They will never risk their lives by coming in the reserve. And if we carry guns, it means it will be the threat to them. So because now we don't carry guns, it will be hard for them to shoot at us, knowing that we are not a threat to them. They will hide if they see us. They will never, ever shoot us. That's our belief. And that's the success that we had for 11 years. We haven't seen any member that is injured because of the poachers. So it's a success to us for now.
Okay, so your eyes and ears, you are information gathering.
Yes.
That is your job.
Yes.
To go in, check spur, and assess whether they...
Check the fence, and then make sure that we do the observation post at night, where we shine the spotlight, where we sit, listen, and look. If we can see maybe lights or hear some voices, because our observation post is next to the water holes where animals go and drink water. So that's where we sit and listen.
Mm.
Yes.
Okay, so your security is in the fact that you are not armed.
Yes, but we do have armed respond guides, males. They do carry guns. So then if we find poachers who are armed, will report to operation room. The operation room, they will call for them. So then they will come and assist. What we need to do is to give them the information that we saw them, they took this direction, or we saw the human spores, which they need to follow up, then ourselves, we just hand over the information and we don't do the follow-ups with them. So they take over from us.
But then the poachers know that the information comes from you. So why would they not in future just shoot you?
Because they know that they will be caught. And don't forget that these people normally, they are not there in the reserves for people.
Do you think they have extra respect for the fact that you are women, and that is another reason why they wouldn't just shoot you?
That's positive. I think they see us as young women from the communities, young women who love nature, young women who are out there to protect the nature, and they know very well that these women are not a threat to us.
So have you had very dangerous times in your job?
We have many incidents of the mambas who are chased with lions, who are chased with elephants, who are chased with buffaloes. But at the end of the day, while they're running, they remember the tricks that they were taught on the training of the animal's behavior. This is what keeps us safe, because we all remember what to do when we are in the bush or when we are in the field.
So how close have you got to poachers, you, yourself?
Myself, I've never been close with poachers.
Mm-hmm.
But some of my colleagues, they do have encounter with poachers, but it was bushmeat poachers.
And what happened?
It was two ladies.
The poachers were two, but...
Mm-hmm. They were camping in the reserve for bushmeat, and then they had a lot of meat. So the members was doing a snare sweep where they find this campsite of those people, and then they arrested them because it was bushmeat poachers. It was not the ones that carrying guns. So they managed to arrest them and then call the armed guard response. And then the armed guard response, they hand over the people to the police. But first, while they were arresting them, they asked them questions. Like, you are ladies, why are you coming in the reserve? Why are you doing this? So that's where the ladies explained that we are doing this for our children. The meat, we are going back to eat it. And some were going to sell it, so then we can buy other food for our families. So that's why we have this program, the Bush Babies program, to teach the children about environment and nature. And then we have center there where they cook for the children, where they help them with the homeworks, where they help them by reading, and then they even have scouts there. That's where we see bushmeat poachers decreasing a lot, because now they see the recognition of the reserve in their community. Because if we hire people from that community, that people in the place where bushmeat poachers come from, if you hire people from there, that's where they can see that we are trying to make something good in their community.
And it's that involvement in the communities bordering the Greater Kruger Park that makes the Black Mambas successful in their anti-poaching efforts. It's a really good model, and it complements the others that are being used to fight this ghastly scourge. Colette Ngobeni, one of the Black Mambas' first recruits in 2013, she became interested in nature conservation at school and through the Bush Baby program that she's just been talking about. So, proof that the model works, and works well. Hoedspruit is a tourist mecca because it's a gateway to the Kruger National Park and some of its neighbouring reserves. It's also on the frontier of the war against poachers who are hell-bent on destroying our wildlife and our wild areas. So it's a khaki town with khaki men in khaki 4x4s. The last thing I expected to find there was a boudoir photography business, and a thriving one to boot. So clearly there are many ordinary ladies in the region with ordinary bodies who want themselves photographed in the altogether. And the man who's providing the opportunity for them to do so is Brent Abramser. He's on a bit of a crusade, really. And this is it.
I want women to feel good about themselves. I want women to feel uplifted about themselves. I've been involved in the fashion industry and that sort of thing, where you see what those models do to themselves to maintain an image. And it's not healthy. And yes, they are. They look good in the eyes of society, because society dictates that we have to look a certain way to be perceived as being beautiful. But that doesn't mean that every other person out in the world is not beautiful in a unique way. And we all have unique features about us, and that's why I do it, is to make people aware, and specifically or predominantly women, aware that they are beautiful irrespective of what size dress they wear, whether they have stretch marks, whatever.
You see, if I wanted to feel better than I do about my body, and I'm not alone in not liking my body at all. I think women, particularly at my age, just loathe what they look like. And my happiness in my truck rests in the fact that I've got a mirror the size of a shaving mirror. And that's all. Really, I can highly recommend it as a way of getting your self-belief back. If I were to seek a way of increasing my self-regard, the last thing I would do, last thing, would be to rip off my gear in front of someone else, definitely someone with a lens. Does it occur to you that it's absurd that women do come to you wanting self-confidence?
Yes, I suppose that it is weird, but I don't question it. I've been doing it long enough that I realize that it's not for everybody. Not everybody is comfortable. Like you say, it's the last thing that you do. However, we all think differently, all have different opinions, and we have different ways of achieving that value that we see in ourselves.
You mentioned before we pressed record that you give the ladies a questionnaire.
Yes.
And that isolates which parts of their bodies they are most proud of and which
Correct.
They would like to
yeah,
have focused on.
So it helps me with the posing and that sort of thing. So I get to understand who they are as a person. It will typically ask, what are your three body parts that you would like to highlight in the photos? What are three body parts that you would like to not display in the photos? How do you see yourself in terms of your body path as it's moved down the years and that sort of thing? And then that helps me to know, okay, this person has a problem with, let's say, their nose or their toes. Okay. So I must know.
He's saying, I've got a problem with my boobs. What are you going to do about my boobs?
And that comes with experience, is to know how to pose the person so that their boobs are shown in a flattering way.
So it's artistry.
Yes, yeah.
It really is artistry. Do you find that your impressions of their body coincide with theirs?
No.
Oh, that's interesting.
No.
So we have these obsessions, these hang-ups about certain parts of our bodies, and we're walking around, and probably most people, guys if we're into guys, girls if we're into girls, are not seeing it that way.
Yep. We are our harshest critics. I find that a lot of my clients come to me and they say to me that they prefer a male photographer doing this work with them than a female photographer, because they find women tend to be overly critical on other women.
So, Brent, along with the questionnaire about what parts of their body they're comfortable with, how do you assess how far they're prepared to push it, so to speak?
Look, they have to decide how far they want to go. And I stress this with every client and every model. It's not up to me. I'm not the one in front of the camera. They have to tell me. I'm not a mind reader. They have to tell me this is
Not cool now.
Not cool now, yeah. And the best way to do it is on that form that I send them out, I ask them, what is your comfort in terms of body exposure? Okay, is it fully clothed? Is it partially clothed but revealing, but you're still clothed? Is it bikini? Is it lingerie? Is it sheer lingerie? Is it partial nudity? Is it full nudity? But yeah, in terms of exposure, that's for them to tell me. And I stress that they must be honest with me. They mustn't think that I'm going to know what their comfort level is.
Surely most of the non-models are coming here because they want to give their husband or boyfriend yeah. something for Christmas.
So there's a variety of reasons why they come. The first reason is, I'd say the majority of reasons where married clients or a client in a fixed relationship comes is to give it to their partner, usually for some occasion. With people getting married, we tend to find that it is they want to give a bridal gift or an engagement gift or something like that. So they do the shoot before the wedding and that sort of thing. We also find anniversary, birthdays, Valentine's days, all those special days, okay, that typically come up. But what I'm seeing more and more and more is that I'm getting clients that are coming to do shoots for themselves, and that makes me happy.
I know that people bring their own gear, but yes. some of them don't. Yes. So you've got a whole range of yes. lacy things,
yeah.
lacy bits in different colors.
Yeah.
This being a safari area, have you got stuff in camo?
Not at the moment, but now that you mention it, I think I need to go shopping. I do have things like hats.
Here's the thing. I can see how you work and how you respond to people, but how do you make these ladies comfortable before you start?
First off, I would say that I don't like them just to arrive here without having met me before. I want them to get to know me a bit as a person. So I think probably how it goes is there's usually a lot of either telephonic or WhatsApp conversation and just general chit-chat that sort of breaks down a little bit of barriers. And then ideally, it's not always possible, ideally I want to meet them. And then, you know, once they get here, number one, Ilse is here.
Ilse being your wife?
Yes.
Yeah.
If Ilse is not here, then I request that they bring a friend with them, that they're not here on their own. And that is, ironically enough, it's my safety net.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay. So somebody is there and they can't say, well, they touched me inappropriately. The other thing is that on the day of the shoot, before we actually pick up the camera, we sit down there outside or inside, whatever the case may be, and we sit and we chat and that sort of thing, and just general chit-chat, like I say, and just break down that sort of nervousness. There is always that nervousness for a first-time client. Generally, I find that within 30 minutes, they're over it. And you can see as the shoot progresses, the images get better and better and more natural, and you can see laughter coming out and that sort of thing. And at the end of the day or end of the shoot, you know, there's lots of laughter going on, and they'll say they really had a great time.
I actually asked Brent to give me a couple of standout incidents that have happened down the years. No doubt he can't talk about most of them, but here's one that I found very amusing.
I planned the shoot down in Durban, and we were still selling our house down there, and I'd arranged to do the shoot, but our estate agent was coming that morning to bring a prospective buyer of our house, and coincidentally the estate agent and my client had exactly the same name, and on my WhatsApp, I WhatsApped her, and this client had requested to do a nude shoot, so I said to her, please just arrive, don't wear any tight clothing, don't wear any underwear, and preferably come as naked as you can to the shoot. And I said this, and this was before the days where you could delete a message from WhatsApp. And I went and said this, and I sent it to our estate agent. And it's one of those scenarios where you wish you could reach into the cell phone, into the ether, and grab that message and pull it back.
But I bet you're sending a second message within 10 seconds.
I did. I said, apologies, that was not meant for you. That was for a client. She knew what I did, what work I do. So we had a good laugh when she brought her client around, or the buyer. They didn't buy the house.
Brent Abramser, boudoir photographer practicing in Hoedspruit. Hoedspruit, of all places, and some surrounding towns too. He's as busy as hell, particularly now, I would imagine, when the Mrs. Smiths of the region want to give their hubbies Christmas prezzies comprising a pic of them with nothing on but Santa's hat. Brent's website is Boudoir by Brent. If you've listened to our Inspirations posting this month, you will know that it features Konrad Drosna, one of the Lofelt's dedicated wildlife warriors. His book, Called by the Wild, contains some unforgettable stories about his life as a game ranger and a trail guide and an anti-poacher. This is one of them, and it took place on Windy Ridge Game Reserve in KwaZulu-Natal, where Konrad was earning his stripes as a ranger and performing all manner of chores on the property.
We had to be up very early in the morning, and all the staff would be in a line, standing next to each other. We would then, okay, today this is what's happening, okay, we're working at that camp, or cutting wood in that side of the farm, or fixing fences, or whatever. And the instructions would be given out in the morning, and then this one specific morning, here was an extra person standing there, and he was kind of like short and stocky. When I say short, just below 5 foot. And I mean, we could smell him from like 10 meters away. He was stinking like crazy. And so I asked the Induna, Obet. I said, Obet, Mbano, who is this? And he said, oh, Mfano. He said, it's a boy. Mfano is a boy. So I said, oh, Mbanegama. Yeah, okay. What is his name? He's like, boy. And so I was like, boy, Uvele boy, like straight, is that his name? And they said, yes, that's his name. So I said, okay, so what's he doing here? No, he wants to come and work. And he's very strong. You could see that this guy's got some serious muscles in his arm. He said, okay, all right, let's give this guy a go. So boy, I mean, you could tell him to do anything which was manual labor. Like, for example, he was good with a pick and a spade. And he was good with working in the vegetable garden. And he could do menial or basic, very basic tasks, because he wasn't meant, his mental faculties weren't very, very
developed.
High. And he had like rotten stumps of teeth, and some of the teeth were missing. Also, he would just literally stay behind the house in a shack. And every week, the guys got their rations, and he would eat his rations as he got them. He would start eating with his hands, but eating the maize meal raw. So, and the rest of the workers would be laughing at him. You know, when he got his pay, because the guys were paid in cash in those days, he would give it away to the other workers, and they would be like, hey, good man, good man. So he had no concept of what cash was about. Eventually what happened was, because at Windy Ridge we used to have international hunters, and international hunters would come out, and they'd do trophy hunting, and these two hunters from, I think it was Spain or Italy, came out, and they both wanted to shoot a baboon for their trophies. So we went out, and the one guy shot his baboon and killed the baboon, and the other guy wounded the baboon, and the baboon ran off. So then for the next 2 days, I spent with this guy, and he was complaining. He was like, why must we go walking around looking for this baboon that I wounded, when I can just shoot another one? And I was like, no, because we are going to go and get the baboon that you wounded. We will not shoot another baboon until we get your baboon that you wounded. And this was in the area where there's a camp called Intiban Camp, a warthog camp, which is where the school groups coming to Windy Ridge would go and stay. And Boy, or Mfan, was working at that camp, and he was digging out pipes. And so we were coming upriver, and then we found that the baboon had died. It had been shot through his stomach. It died a day later. And it was sort of half in and half out of the Inseleni River. And we dragged it up to the camp. And when we got to the camp, a boy was digging at the kitchen. We went to where the car park was, there, right by the kitchen. And because when an animal dies, like not long thereafter, the hair will slip. You get hair slip. So I wanted to get going with skinning this baboon immediately to try and mitigate the hair slip
issue. In other words, the hair comes off.
Yes, the hair follicles come out, and then the trophy will be damaged because once you mount it onto a form or frame, the hair will fall out.
Mm-hmm.
So I then called Boy and I said, oh, bring some wire. We're going to put up a hanging wires and we're going to skin the baboon right here, right now. And I mean, when we hung the baboon up, I could really see he was jittery. And then as soon as I brought the knife out and I brought the knife to the baboon and started cutting the skin, he freaked out completely and literally ran and jumped, holding onto a tree, screaming and screaming, screaming, and then buggered off. And that was the last I ever saw him. But what happened was, is when I was questioning and asking the Nduna, what the hell happened with this whole story? Eventually, he explained that Boy was a very bright young student at school at Mtamanana, which is the village close to Windy Ridge. The other boys were jealous of him, so they beat him and beat him to a pulp to the extent that he suffered brain damage. His parents had died, and so he had no one looking after him. So he just wandered off into the mountains around Windy Ridge and joined up with a troop of baboons and was coexisting one way or another with them. Eventually, he came out, you know, left the troop for whatever reason and came to come and work at Windy Ridge for the while that he did.
In the months that followed, the cattle herders said they saw Boy back with his troop of baboons, no doubt now carrying even more fear and hatred of his human cousins. Konrad Drosner telling us one of the stories contained in his great book, Called by the Wild. And that's it for this month's potpourri. Thanks to the good folk of Hoedspruit for really making me and my microphone welcome. And to Michelle Cochran for carting me around and lots else. I think my guests this month were so big-hearted, apart from being really interesting. They define what Storycatcher is all about, you know. Some brought us life stories, some standout incidents in their lives. Others told us about their careers, and yet more about their brave commitment to the wildlife of our country. It was a fabulous visit, and I'm most grateful, Hoodies. This edition was, for reasons that I don't need to talk about, it was a real monster to get together. So thank you, Ms. Amy Moss, my editor, and her able assistant, Squinks. To David Lamkin for redesigning our podcast page. Hope you like it. And to our website, Magic Man Gus Doyle. Above all, thanks to you, dear listener, for, well, listening. I hope you'll do so again and that you'll keep your ears to the ground for stories. Next month, Grahamstown and its surrounding towns. Ooh, lots of eccentrics there.